Welcome to the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 107.5, 1070 The Fan. The third day of activity at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway complete. Very busy again today with a lot of activity. Our first minor incident, J.R. Hildebrand with a little bit of contact. He's okay. Didn't look like too much damage. Tomorrow, Fast Friday, and we qualify this weekend. I have magically moved from trackside to on location tonight, but Donald Davidson is at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Hello, Donald.
Hi, Kevin. How are you?
I'm great. Good. Let's get right into it. Let's get through as many as we can tonight. Listen to you more than me at 317-239-1070. Questions for Donald, and Bruce starts us off in Rockford, Illinois. Hello, Bruce.
Hello, gentlemen. You guys are sounding great as ever. And my question is about the 83 race. I was in turn one. That was my favorite battle of all time, watching Al Jr. run interference for his dad. It's just breathtaking. And when he slammed the door on Sneva, I mean, I was 20 feet away in turn one. I could reach out and touch it almost. And so I wondered, Donald, if you could give us a little bit of insight. It was tremendous, wasn't it?
Yeah, what is amazing is how heads up little Al was, and he was accused of blocking, and he really wasn't. But the situation was, and I've got to think about this for a moment. There was Tom Sneva, Al Unser, and Rick Mears, and Mears was, although he was up that high, I think he had a bit of a handling issue. And I think that Big Al was leading on the restart, followed by Tom Sneva, and then Rick Mears was third, I think. And I'm not sure if Little Al might have been behind Sneva, but anyway, nevertheless, he got a great start. And I've got to think about exactly where he was. He was a couple of laps down, so not on the lead lap. Anyway, what he did was he got around and got ahead of his dad and then allowed his father to pass or get, you know, pick up a lap because it was not for position. So he gets in front of his dad, lets his dad pass, but then made it difficult for Sneva. And again, he was accused of blocking, and he really wasn't, but he had figured out where he could run to make the turbulence enough that it was very difficult for Sneva to try and overtake. And I don't know that I was aware that he ever actually slammed the door or not, but I know that Sneva told me, he said I was okay for a couple of laps, but then he said I started standing up in the seat because I thought I'm going to have to get by him. And then And then finally he was able to get by Little Al and then go ahead and then get Big Al as well and go on to win. And it seemed to me that Dick Simon got involved in that as well. And I hadn't thought about this for years, but Simon was also a few laps down. But he saw what was going on. And I think he had some reason where he wanted to get involved as well. For a different reason, Little Al was trying to keep Sneva behind him so his dad could win. And then I think that Dick Simon wanted to help. I think he wanted to help the Unsers over a possible something that had happened with Sneva back in the Canadian-American Modified Racing Association days. I'm probably complicating the thing a little bit. But Little Al was docked a position, I think, not a lap. In fact, there was thinking that Steve Chassis, who finished 11th, might be elevated to 10th. And now I'm a little bit hazy on what the penalty was to Little Al, but he ended up finishing 10th, and some people thought that he should have won Rookie of the Year, and that was given to Teo Fabi, and I don't know whether the final laps had anything to do with it or not, or whether Fabi based on his performance in qualifying, winning the pole, and then leading the race early had anything to do with it or not. But anyway, I, considering that Al, little Al, had just turned 21 in April, that it was extremely heads up that he would have not only the presence of mind to attempt what he did, but the fact that he was able to pull it off for a number of laps. I thought that for a 21-year-old, that just showed amazing talent. So I think that probably is about all I got on that one. Kevin?
All right, thank you. Who's next, David? 317-239-1070. Whoever it is, you're on with Donald.
Hello.
Mike in Vernon Hills.
Mike.
Mike, go ahead.
How are you? Go ahead. Mike, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear
All
me?
All right, take it away.
Yeah. Great shows this year, guys. I wonder if you could talk about George Conner, please.
Sure. Boy, I don't know that we've had that one before, or at least not for a long time. George Conner had 14 starts. 1934 was the first year that he was there, but he didn't start the first year. But so I think it's a straight run from 35 to 52, minus, of course, the war years. His best finish, and again, I was talking to somebody earlier. They said, we like the stories. Give us the stories. And I said, you know, for years, I would take the driver and do him year by year. And I've got away from that recently and tried to just do a general overview, and I tripped myself up because it'd probably be better if I started at the beginning and go all the way through. But anyway, the highlights were that he was third in 1949, driving for Lou Moore. There was the front drive cars still being driven by Maury Rose and Bill Holland, and there was a what they called the Baby Blue Crown, which was a smaller version of the front drive cars that was for dirt tracks. It was a rear drive. That was Bill Holland's dirt track car. And so George Conner drove that at the Speedway and finished third behind Bill Holland and Johnny Parsons. That was his best finish. He also had other top tens. He was eighth in 1950 in the rain, and then eighth in what turned out to be his final start in 1952, when he drove for Federal Engineering. And during practice, there was a story that somebody, he had the record for the longest distance traveling backwards. A guy named Bob Laycock, who was the historian at the track before I was, and was a real stats buff, and he would actually write up a complete description of all the accidents, which they don't do now. And so you'd go into the press room, and then it would so-and-so at 151 spun, got sideways, slid backwards for whatever it was. Anyway, so the thing was that, and I don't know why I remember this one, George Conner in 1952 slid backwards for 1,707 feet, and or was it yards? No, it was 1,707 something. Anyway, he was going backwards, and looking over the tail and steering, and then when he finally came to a halt, unscathed, got out of the car, and the Firestone engineers went running down into the turn. And they were amazed to see that the tires were not flat. And while they were standing there and congratulating each other, a minute or so goes by, and then you started to hear these raspberry sounds, which I'm not going to try and imitate right now, and it was the air coming out. And what happened was that he'd slid backwards on the bricks and then on the asphalt for such a distance that the heat built up. It caused the tires, which actually had worn the bottoms out, were actually sealed to the surface. And when the thing cooled off, out came the air. Anyway, George was one of the nicest guys, and it's the old cliche But of all the people that I met that were less like a race driver in appearance and a demeanor, George Connor would be right at the top of the list. In fact, he did appear, I think, in 1953, and it was, I think it was What's My Line? And nobody got it because he came out in a suit and he just looked like he was a banker or something like that. And nobody got that he was a race driver. And he was just the nicest guy to talk to. And also somebody that I wish I'd spent more time with, because the fact that he went back into the 30s and interacted with all of these people that... that were long gone that I wanted to know more about. Now, he had a local connection. There was a fellow named Harry Aiken who was he drove midgets at 16th Street, but he also became a city official. And I'm trying to think if, or was he might have been county treasurer or something like that. He held a political post, Harry Aiken. And he lived in Speedway, and it was his sister, I think, that was married to George Connor. And so the grandson, I remember, went to Speedway High School and had bragging rights that his grandfather was George Connor. He was very successful at Ascot, the Legion Ascot Speedway, which is a very treacherous racetrack, and several drivers met their ends there, and so he was very successful there in the mid-1930s. Okay, Kevin?
Okay, thank you very much. Thanks for the call, Mike. Paul in Racine is up next with Donald Davidson.
Hello, Paul?
Donald. Hi, Kevin.
Hiya.
Hey, Donald, I just want to talk a little bit. I'd like you to talk about Lloyd Ruby, more specifically about his mentoring of Arlene Hiss. But before you do that, you know, you mentioned on yesterday's show about the stock block engine.
Paul, I'm sorry, I didn't hear part of your question.
I guess what I would like you to talk about is Lloyd Ruby, but more specifically his mentoring of Arlene Hiss. But before you do that, I just wanted to share with you, I do remember, I think it was after the 80 or 81 race, Tom Bigelow, I believe, was in the Genesee Beer Wagon Special.
Yes, yes.
Which was like a couple-year-old Penske PC-12 that had a stock block engine that made the whole race distance. And I remember they're saying that there was interest from, like, one of the engine manufacturers after the race of seeing that engine and maybe breaking it down. I remember that being like in the Indianapolis Star. And the only reason I bring that up is because you were talking about the stock blocks yesterday.
Oh, okay then. Well, I wouldn't have anything to add on that, but by golly, Lloyd Ruby, the involvement with Arlene Hiss would be that Ruby was a part owner of that car. It was called Copper State Racing Team. And Arlene Hiss was the separated wife of Mike Hiss. I don't know that I don't know if they were divorced or not, or just separated. But anyway, Mike Hiss was there to actually help Arlene Hiss, and they had an Eagle. It had been the Commander Motorhome Special, another one of those things where Mike Devon was the chief mechanic on that car, and then ended up being the reluctant owner. And I think that Ruby might have had a part of that car. They ran tests at the Phoenix racetrack with Arlene Hiss, and she did very well by herself in the test. And then when they came to the race in March of 76, she qualified, but I think she was the slowest qualifier. She was running at the end in 14th place, so she hung in there for the distance. But as far as how much Ruby had to do with that, I really don't know. But I'll tell you that in In May, that car was entered, and Ruby was hopeful of getting a second car. In 1975, Lloyd Ruby was Johnny Rutherford's teammate on the McLaren team. Pretty unusual there, the fact that Team McLaren had two drivers, and not only were they Americans, but they were both Texans. And so Ruby was an early out. But then the next year, McLaren came with two new cars, and it was for Johnny Rutherford. And it ended up they only ran the one. The second car was kept strictly for if Rutherford needed it. And I think there were a number of Ruby supporters, myself included, were thinking right up to the last minute that Ruby might get that second McLaren, but they never did run it. But anyway, I'm going to insert myself into this a little bit. They entered the Eagle just as sort of like for a true backup. And so at some point when it looked like no other car was going to come, then they decided, okay, let's go. And Ruby was already here. And then Mike Nevin set off with, I think, maybe one or two others to bring the car back. And I, forgive me if I'm putting myself into this, but I did a talk with Lloyd Ruby on this particular occasion. I went and picked him up. The talk was downtown. I went and picked him up at the old the Howard Johnson's. And I'm driving, and we take off, and Ruby says, well, I can't believe my dang luck. And he said, I just got in the room last night about 10 o'clock, and the phone rang, and it was Val. It was Val Miletich. And he said he wanted to know if I'd like to run their second car, Al Unser's backup car. I said, Rube, that's terrific. He said, well, I told him I couldn't do it. And I said, what? Why? He said, well, Mike and them are already on the way back here. He said, in fact, they'll probably be back here, later tonight. And he said, they're already coming. So I just told him I was going to stick with them. And I thought that this is an older Eagle, and you could have had a VPJ Carsworth, just like Ongais has. And no, Ongais wasn't back yet, but certainly Al's backup. And that just out of loyalty to his friends, that he wouldn't do it. And I thought, how many other drivers would do that? So we did the talk, and then we came back after, and the garage area would be open all night in those days. And so we got back to the garage area about 10:15, and they had arrived. And so the little trailer was in the garage area, and the car was unloaded, and all the spares were coming out, and I thought, I wonder if Ruby ever told Mike Devon, hey, I could have driven for Bells, but anyway, so he stuck with that, and the race was stopped at 101 laps because of rain, and Ruby was running 11th. Who knew how far he would have gone? But I remember at one time, shortly before the halfway, Ruby came down the straightaway running off pace next to the wall. And I thought, oh, God, Ruby's out of another one. And then it turned out that he'd hit the kill switch had been hit by mistake, I think is what happened. But anyway, as far as Ruby, just, golly, I wouldn't even know where to start. I know we're going to have to take a break here. There's so many things to talk about him, not just on track, but how he was as a person. In fact, hey, Kevin, can we take a break and come back and talk about Ruby a little bit more?
Certainly we can. We'll do that right in just a moment. More of the talk of Gasoline Alley with Donald Davidson coming up on 107.5, 1070 The Fan. This is the talk of Gasoline Alley, 107.5, 1070 The Fan, nearing qualifying weekend and just over a week away from the greatest spectacle in racing. I'm Kevin Lee. Donald Davidson is at the Speedway, and Peter is in Sacramento, and it's his turn to talk with Donald.
Yes, good evening, gentlemen. I'd like to know about Elmer George, not just as a driver, his driving career, I'd like to hear that, but also what jobs that he held I assume at the Speedway, since he was part of the Holman George family. What jobs did he did after he quit driving?
Well, he was the head of concessions for a while, and for the longest tenure that he had was he was head of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Radio Network. As far as a driver, the highlights, I actually had some Lloyd Ruby stories that I was going to give to, I think it was Paul from Racine, but Elmer George drove in 3 500s. His forte was sprint car racing, and in 1957 he was the Midwest sprint car champion before they had a national sprint car championship. He was also third in 56 behind Pat O'Connor and Eddie Sachs, and then he won it in 57, and then in 58 he was third behind Eddie Sachs and a very young A.J. Foyt. And he won a championship race at Syracuse, New York on dirt, and then the 3 500s that he started were 57, 62, and 63, and the best finish was 17th, but he didn't do all of the driving. He took Paul Russo as a relief driver, and then also A.J. Foyt. Anyway, but the fact that he married Miss Mary Holman, and so he had several positions at the track, and I think I hit the main two. But the radio network, and actually, there were some ideas of his that were implemented, and I can tell you at least two. The fact that they now have the bus rides around the track, that actually was an idea that Elmer had in probably, 57 or so, 58, where people would come to the old little museum on the corner of 16th and Georgetown and say, can we ride around the track? And so we thought one day, well, why don't we do that? I mean, we run the 500 with the month of May, and then we do tire testing. And if we're not tire testing, the track's available. We don't have other races. And so he went down to Jerry Kirchhoff, just down on 16th Street on the other side of the overpass, and he bought 3 Volkswagen buses. And then the drivers would take, 8-9 people at a time, and then do the commentary live with a little microphone. And that was Elmer's idea. And then another one that started in 1967 was to have public address on practice days. To the best of my knowledge, in 66 and earlier, there was no PA on practice days. And the only way that you could find out what was going on was to come out here and bring a stopwatch and time the cars yourself. And then you would get a clue every now and again when you'd look down and see a crew would suddenly jump up and down, and they thought, oh, well, they must have had a good lap. Anyway, that was Elmer's idea. Let's have the PA. And, in fact, I actually did that in, a couple of different days in 1968, and I'm working at USAC, and Elmer called up and said, could you come over and do it? Because the fellows that normally do this can't be here this afternoon. Can you come over and do PA? And that's as much fun as I ever had, because you would sit there and down by the timing stand, you'd get the times, and then you would relay it to the crowd. You could look up in the grandstands and see the wives and the girlfriends and everything and see their reaction. I really enjoyed doing that.
It's good fun, no doubt about that. And I miss being on the fruit stand where you really could see the people. Yeah. But I also admit that it's nice and comfortable to be in the air conditioning. And well, if it's rainy or windy, that's nice too.
I haven't been up there yet, but just the very fact that being on the PA and looking at the crowd and watching their reaction is something that I really enjoyed.
You have a better memory than me. I forgot, so go back and tell us some more about Lloyd Ruby.
All right. Actually, I had about 4 that I was going to do, some shorter than others, and I don't know if it's fair to try and hurry them up here, but different sides of him. He bonded with a sports car driver named Ken Miles. I mean, and Ruby was an excellent road racer and very highly rated by a number of drivers. would single out Ruby as one of the best that they ever ran against. And Jackie Stewart was very complimentary of Ruby as a driver. Anyway, Ruby was a good road racer, part of the Ford program, and he was paired with Ken Miles, who was a Brit living in California. And talk about an odd couple. Ken Miles was quite well educated and did not suffer fools very easily, and would tend to the people that he thought were not worthy of his time. He would zap them so eloquently they wouldn't realize that they were being zapped. But anyway, slow talking Ruby from Texas and he just bonded, and they were like brothers. Several times I'd be with Ruby and he'd be talking about Ken Miles and he'd have tears in his eyes. Another side of Ruby, that he could be a bit of a needler. And I mentioned that Rutherford and Ruby were the teammates on McLaren in 75. On the morning of the race, they had to go to a breakfast trackside where they had sponsors. And I think a lot of the drivers try to avoid the sponsor visits race morning and concentrate. Anyway, they went to this thing. And there was customers, and some people were familiar with racing and maybe, you know, might have been their first time. So somebody asked the question, if the two of you are racing side by side and you're coming out of the fourth turn as teammates and heading for the checkered flag, who wins? And Rutherford opened his mouth, and before he could say anything, Ruby says, well, I reckon either old Rube is going to win her, or whoever's running third is going to win her. So anyway, what else? Take a few moments, and I've told this one on the air, I think, a couple of times, but Bill Puterbaugh and Ruby were very close. And Puterbaugh had been entered here off and on since 1968, but he'd never made the race. And in 75, he had one of the ex-Patrick Eagles that had been set up by George Pignotti, but the speed wasn't quite where they were, and Puterbaugh said, I'm sitting there in the pits, and he said, here comes Ruby and Al, Big Al, Al Unser, and they were not in uniform, and so they said, we've been watching you, and we'd like to help you. Do you want any help? And Puterbaugh says, yes. And they said, well, we've decided that we don't, it'd be too confusing if we both try to help you. So we're going to toss a coin here, and then whoever loses the toss will be your engineer. And so Ruby lost the toss. And so he comes over and he says, all right, well, first of all, he said, you're shutting off way too early. He said, you're shutting off just past the start finish line, not too far. And Puterbaugh says, yeah. He said, you know where the gate is going into turn one? Yeah. Holler all the way down to there. And Puterbaugh said, you're kidding. You're trying to kill me. And he said, Ruby says, no, it'll stick. Trust me. Holler down to the gate and then left. And then he says, all right, now let's see what you got here. And Puterbaugh said, Ruby goes around to the front of the car, and he sticks his cowboy boot underneath the nose cone, and looks down, and then says, drop this down an inch. And then he went around the car and made some other suggestions and how to move the wicker bills and do this and that. And I guess he made several suggestions. And he said, I went out, and he said, I did everything that Ruby told me. And he said, I picked up 6 miles an hour. And he said it just took a couple of minutes. And he said he never even took his hands out of his pockets. But anyway, Ruby was a great guy. And my wife wasn't much into racing, but I took her to some of the social events early on. And she liked Dahlenbach and some of the other people. And she really liked Lloyd Ruby. And we're driving home one night, and she says to me, you know, Lloyd Ruby is very spiritual, and I never forgot that. And it was just he was a kidder, and you know, we'd have a lot of fun, and enjoyed a drink of an eve, as Johnny Parsons Sr. used to say. But he was a really good guy, and he did a lot of charitable stuff. They did the chili cookouts, And I could tell you a bunch of stories about that. And then also his wife was very religious, and Ruby would do a lot of things with her of a charitable nature. But he was a great guy, one of my favorites ever. And what a thrill to know him and you know, gone on a little trip with him, and just you know, I spent time at his house, and he told me the stories, and there's a lot more, but I don't want this to sound too self-serving. So, Kevin, I think it's a time to take another break here.
It probably is. That'll give us a good long final segment. So we'll come back with more questions for Donald on the Talk of Gasoline Alley. If there's a line available, the number is 317-239-1070. This is 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. It's the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. Donald Davidson is ready for your questions, including Jonathan in Chicago next.
Hi, Jonathan.
Good evening, gentlemen. I was wondering if you could talk about Colin Chapman and Team Lotus's involvement at Indy, and if there were any years in the 70s or 80s that there was talk about Lotus ever coming back?
The only time Lotus came back was with... golly, I can't even put a year on this one at the moment, but not that long ago, with Jean Alise and Simone Di Silvestro, and they were black flagged early because they were not running, the officials felt they weren't running within the agreed upon percentage, which was like 107% or something, I don't know. Anyway, Colin Chapman's involvement was 63 through 69, and it came about Dan Gurney drove at Indianapolis for the first time in 62. He ended up qualifying a car for Mickey Thompson, and then immediately left to go to Europe because he had to run the Monaco Grand Prix, and then I think he came back here and practiced, and then went back for the Dutch Grand Prix at Zandvoort, and that was on a Sunday, and then the 500 was sort of like on Wednesday or something like that, 1962. So while at the Dutch Grand Prix, Gurney said to Colin Chapman, boy, you can't believe this thing, and the opportunities for a good lightweight rear-engine car, and Cooper had been there the year before with Jack Brabham. And Gurney said, you really ought to come and see this thing. And Chapman apparently was not particularly interested. He said, come on, you really have to see this. I'll pay your passage, which he did. Dan knew that Ford Motor Company was planning an Indianapolis entry. And so Chapman came, and Gurney got him together with the Ford people. And then a marriage was made, and then... The result was that in 1963, there was a three-car team for two drivers, and Dan Gurney was one of the Lotus drivers, and then Jim Clark, who was not yet world champion, had been the runner-up in 62, and he was going to win it in 63, was the other driver. And Clark finished second, made one stop, and Gurney was seventh. He was down on power, and I've said for years that he made two stops, and somebody very politely pointed out to me that he actually made a third stop. I think the second stop, the wheel wasn't fastened properly, and so he had to come back, so technically he made three. Anyway, in 64, they were back again. Jim Clark on the pole, Dan Gurney starting sixth. And once the race got going, Clark ran second for a while to Bobby Marshman in an earlier Lotus. It was owned by Lindsay Hopkins. And when Marshman dropped out, he actually was trying to lap Johnny White and bottomed out, driving it through the infield a little bit. It ripped the oil plug out, and then there was some handling problems. Clark then reassumed the lead. He led early, and with Marshman out, so he's back in the lead. And then eight laps later, he comes down the main straightaway, and a huge roar went up from the crowd. The tread on the left rear had separated from the carcass and was flapping and flapping and flapping, and in fact, it broke the suspension, and the wheel was folded over. And Clark drove it down the straightaway against the wall and then pulled off into the infield and was out of the race. And then a little bit later, Gurney's car was withdrawn, actually with nothing wrong with it, but Dunlop, the English tire company, there'd been some transatlantic phone calls, and based on the fact that there'd been a terrible accident early in the race that we're not going to go into now, and with Clark having such a narrow miss, they decided for safety reasons that they would pull the second car. And Dan might have finished second or third. I don't know if he could have given Foy to run for his money or not. Anyway, in 65, they came back again, and this time they won. And I should have said that in 63, they were stock block Ford engines, but in 64, they were V8 double overhead camshaft racing engines. So they won it in 65 with Clark. Bobby Johns, the NASCAR driver, who I got to know quite well, finished seventh. And then they were back in 66 and 67 and did not have a good run at all. 68, the Lotus Wedges, they came with actually four wedges. Andy Granatelli, sponsored and not surprisingly, got a lot of the attention. And I always thought that what an odd marriage that was. Andy Granatelli and Colin Chapman, who were completely different demeanors, but the tragedy there, but I'm not going to necessarily go into, I won't go into right now. In 69, they came back. This was Chapman's last year, Lotus's last year. On paper, this looked like it was a phenomenal team. It was four-wheel drive, rear-engine, turbocharged Fords with Mario Andretti, Graham Hill, and Jochen Rindt. And when that team was announced, we, you know, some of us thought, well, there's the front row right there. How many of them qualified? None. Mario, who kind of ran separately from the other two, Chapman had Hill and Rindt, and Mario was off with Clint Brunner and Jimmy McGee, and they were kind of sort of separated from Chapman's influence, and there was some accusations back and forth about who was getting the preferential treatment and so on and so forth, but I'm not going to elaborate on that right now. But the first weekend of qualifying was rained out, and so on the Wednesday between the two weekends with nobody qualified yet, and Mario running the fastest and obviously going to be the pole winner, had a hub break and a massive crash coming out of turn four. And he was running like 172 miles an hour. But the car was destroyed. And in the meantime, Hill and Rindt were running about 10 miles an hour slower than that. And when they came to qualifying, they never made a run, and I think it was on the Saturday night, night before what was going to be the final day, they decided to pull the plug. So when everybody came to the track on, there was a meeting at a hotel out by the airport, I am told. Somebody that was a bit ended up being an interloper on the meeting, and said that they had they decided to pack up and go home. So when we came back, came to the track on Sunday morning, Rindt had already left. He didn't like the place. And here was Graham Hill going around shaking hands with everybody. But anyway, so that was the Colin Chapman Lotus involvement from 63 through 69. And it just changed the face of racing, because what Brabham and the Cooper started and Mickey Thompson tried to continue on, Chapman and Lotus just took it to the next level. And after the win in they went in 1964, there were 12 rear engine cars in the race. In 65, there were 27 rear engined and six fronts. And 66, there was only one front engine car. 67, there was none. 68, there was one, and then that was it. So that changed the face of racing forever. And so that's about it for Colin Chapman at the Speedway. And then, of course, the Lotus coming back in a year I still haven't pulled up in my mind, with Jean Alise and Simone de Silvestro. Is that like 2010 or something?
Maybe I'm going to say 12, but I'm not certain about that. It's around 2012, and you, you described it accurately. Oh, no, you're right. David says it was 2010.
Was it 10? All right. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I was at that race, yeah.
Okay.
I should always trust you. We've got time, I think, to sneak down. No, we don't. I'm sorry, Seth. Call David tomorrow night, and he'll remember you, and you'll be first leading us off tomorrow night at 8 o'clock back in our normal location. I appreciate everyone accommodating my schedule a little bit this evening. Donald, thank you. I'll see you at the track tomorrow night at 8 o'clock.
All right, Kevin. Thank you, everybody, for calling.
Thanks to David Deering back in our studio, and thanks to everyone for listening tonight. We'll see you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock for Trackside. Track open tomorrow morning at 10, and Fast Friday, we'll hope for good weather from 11 until 6. This is 107.5, 1070 The Fan.